This is Nachyomi, Sefer Shofetim, Chapter 7. 32,000 troops rally around Gideon for the battle against Midian. Hashem tells Gideon that this is not acceptable. He can't go out to battle with such a large group because this might give the Jewish people the impression that it is their might and their military prowess that is bringing them victory rather than Hashem's intervention. So Gideon instructs anybody who has any hesitation or any fear to return home. 22,000 of them do so, but he still has 10,000 troops under his command. Finally, Hashem tells Gideon to go by the water. Any soldier who gets down on his knees to drink from the water will be sent home, and any soldier who laps up the water with his hand without lowering himself to the ground will remain. At the conclusion, only 300 soldiers are left with Gideon. Hashem tells Gideon to mobilize his forces against Midian and to go fight. However, and Hashem does promise him that he will be victorious in the battle. However, he also offers Gideon one more opportunity. If he's feeling insecure, if he's feeling unsure, he offers him one more sign. He says, go with your attendant and listen in on conversations that are happening in the Midianite camp. So Gideon and Purah, his assistant, his attendant, sneak over enemy lines and they go and listen to a conversation between two Midianim. One is telling the other a dream. The dream is about this enormous barley cake that was tumbling and rolling through the camp and ended up flipping over and flattening his tent. And his friend, who's listening to this dream, tells him, you know what that barley cake represents? It represents Gideon and how he is going to triumph over Midian. He's going to defeat Midian in a decisive way. Gideon, hearing this, is now even more confident and even more determined and goes back, divides the 300 soldiers into three groups, each group of 100 soldiers, and each group is given, each individual rather, is given a shofar, a torch, and a pitcher. And the plan is to put the lit torches inside the pitchers so that it's still dark and the Midianim don't notice them. They're going to be doing this in the middle of the night, of course. And then as soon as Gideon blows his shofar, everybody else will blow their shofarot, smash their pitchers, revealing the torches inside. So all of a sudden, the camp of Midianim will be surrounded by torches that light up the night. And this, the plan is, will intimidate and scare them and give the Jews the upper hand in defeating them. In fact, that's what happened. Gideon says, when I blow the shofar, everybody is to blow the shofar and say, for Hashem and for Gideon, that this battle is going to be won by Hashem and by Gideon, or for the sake of Hashem and for the sake of Gideon, depending on how you understand it. And then at that moment that they smash the pitchers, they'll get the upper hand in the battle. And that's indeed what happened. Gideon blows the shofar. Everybody else blows their shofarot. They smash the pitchers. The light comes out. The people fall into a complete panic. And they not only start running, but they start killing each other. In other words, the Midianim are killing their own soldiers because there's mass hysteria. Now, why did this work? It worked because generally only a small fraction of the troops carry torches or blow shofarot. Not the majority of them, and certainly not all of them. So when they saw 300 in the middle of the night, they are awakened by 300 shofarot, and they see 300 torches around them. They assume that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of troops surrounding them, and that these are just the ones that are holding the torches and holding the shofarot. So they that's what causes them this tremendous panic. They're intimidated, they're overwhelmed, and they go a little bit crazy, and they start killing one another and trying to flee the scene. In the end, the Jews are able to vanquish their enemies. A few of the princes, four of them actually, of the princes of Midian escape. Gideon sends word ahead to the people of Ephraim to seize Orev and Ze'ev, who have run in that direction. They do so, and they are able to execute Orev and Ze'ev. There are two on the loose that will be apprehended in the next chapter. But as this chapter concludes, the battle is almost over. Now, there are a couple of details of the story that require some explanation. The most basic one is, why did Hashem want to downsize the army of Gideon? We see that in other instances, a large army is perfectly fine. When Yehoshua went to fight Ai, one of the criticisms we saw, according to some of the commentaries, was that he was too confident in his ability to win, that Hashem would hand them over the battle, and therefore they didn't strategize enough. They didn't use enough troops. So why is Hashem here removing or lowering the number of troops that Gideon has at his disposal? Secondly, why does Gideon keep having to be given signs again and again that Hashem is with him? And I'd like to suggest that really what we see here is an element of Gideon that we're actually going to see even more of in the next chapter. And that is that his insecurity and his fear really is covering up an insecurity about himself. In other words, the insecurity in trusting Hashem points to the fact that really he feels that he is the one that needs to win the war. Really, he feels that it rides on his shoulders. He's the one who's responsible, and he feels inadequate to that. He doesn't feel that he's going to be able to defeat Midian. And really, deep down, he believes that he is the critical piece here. He is the one who's going to determine whether the battle is won or lost. So as much as he protests that he feels Hashem is not with him, really that's a sign that he's feeling insecure about himself, and he's actually attributing too much of the responsibility for winning or losing to himself. We can see this from the fact that as a battle cry, he decides on for Hashem and for Gideon, placing him, so to speak, on an even footing with Hashem. He conceives of himself as really central to the winning of the battle, whether that is, obviously he does play an important role, but the whole idea of Hashem lowering the number of troops, the whole idea of Hashem giving him these signs, the whole idea of Hashem insisting that the battle be won in a way where it's clearly miraculous is to play against this idea, to show Gideon that it's not him, it's not his ability or inability upon which the success is contingent. We see a similar thing with Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moshe Rabbeinu protests to Hashem over and over again that he's not going to be able to do the job of liberating the Jews from Egypt. When Hashem finally, so to speak, loses his patience with Moshe Rabbeinu and says, fine, you know what? Aharon is going to be your spokesperson then. Why does Moshe get punished for insisting that he won't be able to speak before Paro? He has a heavy tongue, and he's not able to be articulate enough to face Paro. It shows that he thought that his own ability to be articulate was really the critical thing. It shows that he felt that his own language and his own rhetoric was what was going to be the defining factor in freeing the Jews. And therefore Hashem said, you know what, because you think that, that means that if you do succeed, if you do make it, you're going to think that it was because of your great rhetoric. You're not going to think it was because of Hashem. So instead, I'm going to give it over to Aharon. And so here too, Hashem wants to make clear, he knows that Gideon is worried because he thinks that whether he wins or loses is up to him. And so Hashem is trying to show him that that is not the case, that really it's up only to Hashem. Another interesting aspect of the story is, why is it that going down on one's knees to drink water disqualifies a person from being in Gideon's camp? So the commentaries generally say that this is because those who went down on their knees were accustomed to idolatry. This was that they were accustomed to bowing to the Baal by going down on two knees. And so anyone who had this habit was most likely an idolater. And as we've seen before, Gideon, who is called first in this chapter Yerubaal, meaning he was now defined as an iconoclast, as somebody who rejected idolatry, and that was essential for him to succeed, that he represent Hashem and be totally and utterly dissociated from idolatry. It was also critical that his troops be individuals who had not participated in idol worship and were themselves worthy representatives of Hashem.